From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This is a story of a social reformer, a famous campaigner against slum housing, and a device that made his campaigning effective. Imagine it's 1888, New York City. The Lower East Side is the most densely populated place on Earth. Block after block of tenements house the working poor immigrants of the city. Italians, Irish, Germans, Jews, Czechs, Chinese. Imagine the darkness of an unlit corridor in one of those tenements, a corridor that opens onto windowless rooms 10 feet square, where entire families live, and might even work, too, sewing or rolling cigars. Out of the darkness, a door opens. A man with a Danish accent leads a team of amateur photographers who are accompanied by a policeman. They position their camera on a tripod and ignite a mixture of magnesium and potassium chlorate powder. A flash illuminates their squalor. It would take the photographers a few minutes to reload that early ancestor of the flashbulb, and then on to another tenement scene. And despite the blackness of a room or an unlit street, a picture is taken, a document of urban poverty. In the late 1880s, a New York City police reporter named Jacob Riis, that's spelled R-I-I-S, took pictures that way in Lower Manhattan.
We're on the corner of Baxter and Baird Street.
There are a couple of new books about Jacob Riis, and Bonnie Yokelson co-authored one of them.
One of Riis's most famous pictures was taken on Baird Street. It's called 5 cents a spot. At the time, it was legal to charge 7 cents for someone to sleep for the night, and this place, this 5 cents a spot place, was illegal. There were over 20 people in the room, including a mother and a baby.
Yeah, a spot didn't mean a room. A spot meant a piece
place
of floor,
on the
perhaps.
Floor. Exactly.
In a room with
exactly.
strangers.
And when you look at this picture, you see the shock on the faces of the many people who are on the floor and sort of bunk beds in the back.
They must have been shocked. Magnesium flash powder was something new. It was developed in Germany in 1887. Riis's burst of light must have been a stunning surprise, but it made the dim, airless lives of the poor visible to the middle class. In public slideshows and in his book, How the Other Half Lives, Riis, who was born in Ribe, Denmark, used those images and his descriptions to jar the conscience of prosperous native-born Americans.
Well, we're crossing Canal Street and headed down to what was in Riis's day the notorious Mulberry Bend.
A few days ago, we took a walk with Bonnie Yokelson and her co-author Daniel Sitram through Mulberry Street. It's recently gentrified, but this was where Riis campaigned against the housing conditions of the day. Sitram is a historian.
You can still see the really small size of the building lots. The typical building lot in New York for a tenement was 25 feet wide and 100 feet deep going back. And if you look at some of these buildings, you can see that the front is only about 25 feet, 4 or 5 stories. And that's one of the things that Riis railed against, the small size of the building lots and the fact that people used up the whole lot, which led to the fact that a lot of these tenements, the so-called rear tenements, built behind other tenements, would have no access to light or air.
And all of the rooms were interior rooms
in those units. Interestingly enough, up through the 1890s, there were a series of court decisions. One of my favorite ones was essentially saying that there is no right to light or air for a renter or an owner. And so the idea that you have somehow a right to a window or the right to some breathing space was not a legal right that anyone recognized until much later.
That's Daniel Sitram. His co-author, Bonnie Yokelson, is a curator at the Museum of the City of New York. She writes about Jacob Riis's photography. Riis thought of himself as a writer, and he was evidently a gripping storyteller in the lectures that he gave to accompany his lantern slideshows. Yokelson says that he was a passionate reformer, but he was also very conservative. He believed that Protestant philanthropy and the self-restraint of ethical landlords was the best remedy, not the government. And he was very much a product of his time.
Riis organized his most famous book, which was a bestseller and launched his career as a reformer, How the Other Half Lives, as a kind of slum tour, going neighborhood by neighborhood and describing ethnic group by ethnic group. That was a pre-established literary genre, which he was borrowing. It had a lot of entertainment value. It was come see the colorful Italians and the mystifying Chinese, and there was this sense of he was playing on the entertainment value of these stereotypes. So on the one hand, there was a sort of racial typology that he believed in, but it was also popular culture. And he abandoned that after How the Other Half Lives.
One of the things that makes Rees so fascinating are these contradictions in his work. I see Rees more as a transitional figure. He's somebody that did bring with him those stereotypes and that sort of racialized thinking of the day, but he's also somebody that began insisting on the importance of environment. Or as he put it at one point, it's the squalid houses that make for squalid people.
Rediscovering Jacob Rees, the book that Bonnie Yochelson and Daniel Sitrim collaborated on, is one of two new books about Rees. The Other Half is the title of a new biography by Tom Buxfienti. He's a Danish historian who only heard of Rees when he was a Danish newspaper correspondent in the U.S. Rees was once one of the most famous men in this country, a close friend and confidant of President Theodore Roosevelt, the epitome of the immigrant made good, good in his case being measured by political and social influence, not by wealth. But Tom Buxfienti says all that success didn't impress the Danes back in Rees's hometown of Ribe.
That is very difficult for Americans to understand. The mindset is so different in Denmark, or at least was very different. I mean, although this was not a rich town, it was sort of a place where there was a lot of scarcity. And you sort of had the opposite philosophy as you do in America. If someone does well, people are sort of mistrusting of that person because they believe maybe he's taking something away from me. If my neighbor does well, maybe he's sort of taking something away from me. And it's sort of a place where you cherish the egalitarian values. So if someone sticks out, people are mistrusting that person. So when he came back later as a famous person, he was almost cold-shouldered. And it's very, very strange. And Rees couldn't really understand that himself because he had become an American in that process. He was very proud of his achievements. But people, they were just very skeptical.
I mean, the attitude being sort of, who do you think you are, Mr. Big Shot?
Exactly.
Buxfienti tells the story of how young Jacob Rees, the underachieving son of a schoolmaster, set off for America when the girl he adored turned down his proposal of marriage. He worked in the U.S. as a carpenter, and in the financial panic of 1873, he experienced unemployment firsthand.
He himself experienced extreme poverty. There was a time where he just didn't have a place to sleep. He had no money. He was totally penniless. When he came, worked as a journalist later, and he worked in the tenement districts also as a police reporter, he knew by experience that this mass of poor people were not sort of faceless people, but they were, like himself, people that came to America in order to try to make a better living. So he felt empathy with these people and could write about them because he knew what they were going through.
And he, when he experienced poverty, he experienced it not as someone who had fled famine or extreme poverty in the old country, but who had actually been the school teacher's son and had known some comfort back in a very old world part of the old country.
Yeah, that's a very precise way to put it. He didn't know better. He thought that the rest of the world was like Denmark.
Poverty struck Jacob Rees as something abnormal, even for the various immigrant groups whom he regarded as exotic. When he lived in New York City, about 40% of the population was foreign-born. It's just about the same share today. Millions of immigrants were in the process of becoming American. Tom Buxfienti studied Rees's diaries and says he's found the moment when the Danish carpenter, he wasn't yet a reporter, became an American, mentally. He says it happened when Rees learned that the girl back home, the one he'd been pining for, had gotten engaged to a Danish military hero.
Now, when he learned about that, and at that time he had been in the U.S. for a couple of years, he was shocked. I mean, that came for him as a total surprise, and his world, you could say, went dark for a few days. He's sort of resting in an inn, and he's writing about that, and he says, there's nothing more left for me, and he writes all this in Danish. But what happens a few days later, which I find very significant, is that all of a sudden he begins to write in English.
It's a remarkable turning point when you decide to change the language in which you write the diary, which at least that point, Rees would have no reason to think would be a document that people would pore over in libraries. It was a very private document.
It is. It's very remarkable. It's almost eerie when you sit with that diary and you have it in your hands and you just can see that something is changing in this man.
Tom Books Fiente's The Other Half is being published in this country in August. The book uses a famous Jacob Riis photo on the cover. It's a street scene, and Bonnie Yochelson took us to the place where Riis shot it. It's now in the middle of Columbus Park.
Where we're standing in this park is the site of Riis's most famous photograph, which is Bandit's Roost. He actually put the address of Bandit's Roost on the negative sleeve of that image, which was 59 and a half Mulberry.
I want you to describe the picture.
The picture shows an alley with laundry hanging in the background. On the left side is a mother with two children and some ash cans, some garbage cans out in the alley. And on the right side are a group of bandits, sort of scary-looking guys, hovering and hulking and looking at the camera in a threatening way. So it's both, it has a kind of romanticism to it and an exotic air and a sort of sinister air. It's actually very cinematic.
Think Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York, that's what it looks like. And Jacob Riis, who died in 1914, might not have resisted that comparison. He was a social reformer who was also, with his slideshows and his lectures, a natural showman. Historian Daniel Citrom.
I do think Riis is the first muckraker. I think he represents sort of the beginning of a certain progressive sensibility. And by that I mean this. Riis believed that it was important, that it was crucial to try to rouse the conscience of the public, to appeal to the conscience. This belief that if we could simply expose conditions, if people simply knew how bad things were, they would rise up and change them. And that becomes a real hallmark, it seems to me, of the progressive era, progressive reform. And the photograph really was the way that, you know, he tried to do that, along with the journalism.
And along with that chemical reaction that made the obscure lives of the poor brightly visible to the rest of the country. Daniel Citrom and Bonnie Yochelson's book is called Rediscovering Jacob Riis. That sound of the 19th century flash, by the way, is from a 21st century hobbyist, and we'll hear from him in a moment. And Jacob Riis's beloved Elizabeth, the woman in Denmark who turned him down in favor of the military hero, well, as the story goes, the hero died. Riis wrote to her. She answered. He went back to Denmark and married her. Biographer Tim Books Fiente says there was never any doubt in Riis's mind that they would live in America, which they did. You can read about that and see some of Riis's pictures at npr.org.